Chapter 7. New Laws and New Chicaneries. When my father came home, he had changed completely. He was older and hardly spoke at all. The Nazis did not give us much time for that. Neither did we have time to rejoice over our father's rescue, or to mourn my lost brother. We were emotionally, physically, and morally overcome by this new series of bitter events. In the town and in the surrounding areas, the mass arrests of Jews and Poles increased. New groups of prisoners arrived daily. The prison was overflowing. Almost every day, tortured to death people were turned over to the Judenrat, not only for burial, but also as a deterrent. The buildings of the former municipal authorities, in the back of which a prison had been set up, now became the Gestapo's slaughterhouse, in which hundreds of people were harassed, tortured, and then buried behind the house. Jews were usually given the honor of digging the graves. Through my work for German authorities, I once came into this building by coincidence. I saw the walls spattered with blood, whips, instruments of torture, and the special tables for beatings. I also heard the cries of beaten people which still ring in my ears today. One of the sadistic SD officials was Auenstein, a choleric, brutal character whose name and voice I will never forget. Also the names Hein, Kaiser, and Engels have stayed with me. Friday was the most infamous day of the week because of the laws and decrees issued against us. Everything seemed to confirm the existence of an organization that invented new anti-Jewish laws every week. One of these Fridays brought the so-called fur decree. We Jews were not allowed to own furs, since they were sorely needed for the triumphant German army, which in the meantime was freezing in Russia. The order required, among other things, that we turn over not only fur clothing, but also every piece of fur and all other materials which resembled fur, be it from a sleeve or a dress decoration or from hats. Violations were punishable by death. At that time, Jews hardly owned any fur, since most of it had already been exchanged for food. Nevertheless, this order gave the Nazis a new excuse to shoot Jews. One day, some Gestapo agents came to our neighbor, the hairdresser, Mr. Neumann. They claimed that they had smelt burnt fur and therefore proceeded to shoot Mrs. Neumann and her daughter. This fur action was responsible for many deaths in the town. Repeatedly we were told of new arrests and shootings. For example, Bear Lichtenstein, who was called Midlarnik, was turned over to the Judenrat for burial after having been sewn in a straw mattress. During the internment, someone discovered that he was still alive, but on orders from the Gestapo, he had to be buried immediately. The former driver, Beryl Yohl, who had climbed his way up to the stablemaster under the Gestapo, was most often commissioned to transfer in the dead bodies to the Judenrat for burial. The relatives of those who were arrested and murdered often recognized the clothes the victim wore as those of their loved ones. Yohl was suspected of cooperating with the Gestapo. Everyone was afraid of him. It did not take long, however, before even this hero was shot by the Gestapo. We sighed with relief and almost felt satisfaction at his death. We regarded this incident as a good act by the elder of the Jews. One could see his contentment. Some people even thanked him, for which he was quite reassured. For the Nazis, this was the time of their lives. Having absolute authority, they could take and make use of anything that belonged to Jews. Thus it happened that a captain of the Schutzpolizei became attracted to a very pretty young Jewish girl, who apparently stole his heart. Because of the captain's affection, the girl was able to live better and more securely than other Jews. She was seductively beautiful and soon got to know other police officers. Next to the elder of the Jews, she advanced to the position of Shtetlanut. As much as possible, she tried to help with regard to work obligations, Aktionen against Jews and other Tsuras. Our Miss F. was something of a small Queen Esther. I doubted, however, that this little queen knew anything about the Nuremberg racial laws. As a man, one could understand how the proud captain regarded Rassenschande, racial disgrace, as a burden, and forgot it when he was close to her. But one day one of her friends and protectors showed up in her apartment. I do not know how long he stayed, but when he left, she lay dead in her bed in a pool of blood. He had shot her in that part of her body where he probably had enjoyed her most. Thus he was saved from being tried for Rassenschande. Thanks to our work for the German authorities, Simon and I one day had the unique opportunity to see a movie for German soldiers in the Scala Theatre. The theatre had belonged to a Jewish woman, but of course it was confiscated and reserved exclusively for members of the German Wehrmacht. The film, Jud Sus, was being shown. What impressed me most, however, was the newsreel. It must have been 1941, shortly after the German invasion of Letland and Lithuania. The audience, mostly from the Wehrmacht, was shown how their triumphant German brothers conquered Riga, entered the local synagogue, drove the Jews together, desecrated the building, unrolled the Torahs on the floor, and trampled them. The Jews were then forced to do likewise and were ridiculed and abused. Finally, the synagogue was set on fire. The laughing soldiers on the screen, the bellowing comments from the audience, and the poisonous tin voice of the newsreel commentator still echoes in my ears today. Around that time, the SD official Engels, a man from the Rhineland, called me one morning from his window. "Hey, Jew, come here." I entered his house. He had just arisen and was not yet entirely dressed. He ordered me to sit on a stool, gave me shoe polish, a brush, and a cloth. He sat, actually lay, down in a deep, soft chair, stretched out his legs with his boots out, in front of my face, and commanded, "Jew, shine my boots." I began to work. He then started talking. "What actually are you, you Jew? You're not a dog, or a horse, or an animal. But then you're not a human being either. You are just a Jew. A Jew." I kept silent and tried to control myself without showing my feelings. In the meantime, he noticed that his boots were shined. He got up and dismissed me with the dignity of his belief in the master race. He neither thanked me nor gave me the expected kick. He simply said, "Go away, Jew." I left and did not even feel humiliated. But this incident gave me cause for reflection. What kind of a monster was that? And what kind of diabolical ideas did he have that would enable him to order a human being to shine his boots and to carry on such a conversation? What kind of perversion, sadism, or ideology moved such a person? A large part of the town's Jewish population was working to build a military field at Marianki, about 5 to 10 kilometers from Radzin. This airport was built in a hurry for the invasion of Russia. People worked day and night. Due to bad nutrition and insufficient clothing, they suffered greatly from the cold. Jews were used only for hard labor and had to fight with pick and shovel against the frozen ground. Depending on the mood of a particular guard, they were either tortured or improperly treated. Despite everything, this was a tolerable transition period, since one had a feeling of doing something useful, and it also gave us a right to live. This usefulness was turned to financial advantage by the Judenrat. After the invasion of Russia, the Germans abandoned the airfield, the work was stopped, and we were deprived of the hope of working and maintaining the accompanying security. Despite our disastrous situation, we never forgot how to laugh. For months, a decree was enforced that required all Jews to salute German soldiers by taking off their hats. Naturally, it often happened that a soldier on the other side of the street was overlooked and not saluted. Some Jews were beaten for that. To avoid breaking this law, we decided to take off and put on our caps continually while walking down the streets. Our strategy soon was discovered and regarded as ridicule and disrespect for the German uniform. Immediately, saluting a German soldier was outlawed and enforced by capital punishment. Only laughing was not yet punishable by death. Not yet. One day, while the saluting decree was still in effect, I rode past an on-duty gendarme without saluting him or taking off my cap. Because of my job, I was so privileged that I was allowed to ride a bicycle during working hours. Reaching for his carbine, he called me back, slapped my face, and ordered to pass him 10 times. Each time taking off my cap. I did what he demanded, but without looking at him. I did it 12 times. The offices of the Judenrat were on the Kosiak-Kalanstrasse. Moreh Hara had lived there before, and there was a small house of prayer there. Lichtenstein, the elder of the Jews, lived in our neighborhood, in the house of the Slimak family. Jewish men and women often came to him with their problems, which occasionally produced some shocking scenes. Through my connection with Lichtenstein's son, Simon, I frequently visited their apartment, where I saw and heard a few things. Once I saw a package being prepared for mailing. It contained gold, jewellery, and other valuables, and was addressed to Fischer in Erfurt. Fischer was the Gestapo chief of Rajin town and district. I noted the city Erfurt. Fischer's name I did not have to write down, since I could never forget it. But I will come back to that story later. Now only the present counted. To deal with it was the watchword of the hour. It was only important to protect oneself from beatings, pain, and chicanery, to have enough food and to stay alive. Every Jew, regardless of age or sex, was waging this battle. After our preoccupation with father and the mourning for my brother, new sorrow befell my family. My aunt, Chaya Turkeltaub, hid out of fear of a forthcoming Aktion against the Jews. Her hideout was a Polish farm in the village of Zabikow, about 6 kilometers from Radzin. I do not know whether it happened by accident or during a search, but she was found, recognized as a Jew, and shot immediately. The gendarmerie continued its search in other houses where they discovered 2 more older Jewish women, Mrs. Geliebter and Mrs. Steinberg, who they also shot. When we received the news of the tragic events, my cousin Mendel Turkeltaub and relatives of the other murdered woman hired a Polish driver with a horse-drawn wagon and went to Zabikow and proceeded to the village to retrieve the corpses and bury them at the Jewish cemetery in Radzin. The gendarmes stopped the wagon in front of the village, asked the 3 passengers what they wanted, and then, having identified them as Jews, shot them as well. Later, the Judenrat was also denied permission to bury the murdered Jews. They all remained lying on the roadside, superficially covered with dirt by some farmers. These murders, especially the way in which the 7 innocent people, 3 older women, 3 or 4 young men, were killed, upset the Jewish population of the town. The farmers of the village and the Polish driver told us that the murderers belonged to a gendarmerie unit, most of whose members came from Hamburg to be stationed in Radzin. We saw these men every day. They looked like everyone else, but they were killers. Killers in uniform. We felt deep grief. We wept for our dead. Everyone felt like a victim, since we knew that each bullet was directed at every person of the Jewish faith and ancestry. My aunt had been a modest, meticulous woman who was deeply loved and appreciated by her husband and son. Her only son was killed on the same day by the same murderers. Her husband, Uncle Nathan, who normally had a good sense of humor, changed completely. He suffered and reacted differently than most others. As a religious Jew, he had kept a kosher house, prayed every day, and gone to the synagogue regularly. From that day on, however, he purposely did everything that is forbidden in the Jewish religion. He was not only disappointed in people, but in God as well. He had the courage to say what many thought. Nobody contradicted him. Everybody showed understanding. His famous sense of humor disappeared. He no longer told stories about the 10 years he spent in Russia as a soldier of the Tsar, or any more jokes about the shtetl and its characters. He did not understand the world anymore. His vitality was dissipated. He no longer fought for his life. He used his energy only for insolence. Despite prohibitions, he went outside the town without the required armband, and from one misadventure he never returned. In this way, his wish not to be sent to Treblinka was granted.